We thought, dear friends, that it might not be amiss just briefly to review some of the events of the past so as to get a proper bearing for the lesson of this afternoon. We would remind you that Jacob was on his return trip to the land of Canaan. He had come from Canaan into Mesopotamia and Aram, there to search out a wife for himself.
There he had spent many years
in service and labor. The time came, however, when he had to flee from Laban, his father-in-law. And dear friends, it is true that in some of our experiences, it is also often necessary that we flee. Yet in others, we ought to stand still and overcome. One such experience is brought before us in this lesson when Jacob fled from Laban, his father-in-law, and had it not been for the interposition of Jehovah God on his behalf, his fleeing might have proved useless. But God, when he interposed, saw to it that Laban would not touch Jacob. It was much as the Lord in another instance through one of his prophets had declared, "Touch not mine anointed." Not that Jacob was an anointed one in the sense that you and I are the anointed of the Lord, but he was one whom the Lord had set apart as the heir of the promise, the promise which had originally been made to Father Abraham and to his own immediate father, Isaac. And even as he had to flee, as it were, for his life, fleeing would do you and me no good either, unless the Lord himself interposed, took our part, and since greater is he that is for us than all that can be against us, there isn't a possibility of any harm ever reaching us, for all things work together for good to those that love the Lord, the called according to his purpose. Now we would like you to note, dear friends, that while he fled from Laban, it was God who said to Laban, "Don't you talk to him from bad to good, or from good to bad." The thought is this, that sometimes we do come together and greet each other beautifully, but before we get through, well, in the vernacular of the day, we might be in each other's hair. Not actually so, of course, but figuratively speaking. Of course, God permits these things, but he also sees to it that those who are truly his, the heirs of the promise, are not touched, are not harmed. Great peace have they who love thy law, and nothing shall stumble them, nothing shall beset them, nothing shall offend them. I am sure, dear friends, that we've all had such experiences, not necessarily among ourselves, but oft times in the world, and the people that we have to deal with in the world. I have sometimes wondered as to why it was that after the many years that we had worked for the firm with which we were employed, when they were letting out people, they didn't let us go too. Only 5 of our whole department were still left of the 25 that went uptown some years ago. I seem to feel that God, in his providences, would not allow them to let me go for one reason or another. Not that I can see the providences of God too clearly, But as I look back over the way, it seems to me there were others, some having been with the firm much longer than I, who were let out, and some who hadn't been there so long. I can't see why I should have been kept, except that perhaps it was the overruling providence of God. And I feel that nothing ever happens by accident to those that are the Lord. Whatever comes, comes by divine permission. It may not have been his will originally, but if Satan does interpose, God can stop him. But if God permits it, we can be assured that it will work out for our highest good. And so, in this particular instance that we have in mind, we find that Laban and Jacob were reconciled. But no sooner had he been reconciled to Laban than the fear of Esau overcame him. Now, this wasn't something that he could flee from. This was something which originated within himself, and for good reason. This was something he needed to overcome. Yet you and I are not always able to overcome the fear that arises within us, at least not in our own strength. It would be like endeavoring to lift ourselves up, as it were, by our bootstraps. It couldn't be done. We might jump into the air a little bit and hold onto our bootstraps and get the sensation that we were lifting ourselves, but we couldn't stay up there very long, could we? And so you see, dear friends, that God again had to interpose, and it was at the brook Jabbok, where at Peniel, God revealed himself. Do you remember that in overcoming the fear that he had of Esau, it wasn't Jacob who first wrestled with God, but it was God through his angel that wrestled with Jacob? It is important that we get that picture before our minds. God is the one who commences the wrestling. He's the one that takes hold of us, and then we must struggle to maintain our identity. Not that God couldn't destroy us, as the angel might have destroyed Jacob in a moment, but the angel limited his own strength. So God never permits any trial or difficulty to come to you or to me that is any more than we can bear. But if we would be victorious, the chances are that when we come out of the battle, there will be a weakness, a lameness in our flesh. The old self will have been purified. You won't be able to walk the way you once walked in the world and among those who knew you in the world. And so we see God sometimes finds it necessary to lame his creatures. I do know this, that shepherds sometimes, when there is a wayward sheep who will not be admonished in any other way, find it necessary to break that lamb's little leg. And then, of course, during the period of convalescence, the shepherd will smother it with kindness. And this kindness gradually wins over the little sheep, the little lamb, and thereafter it is more faithful. The shepherd David of old said, The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. And once there was one who said, before I was afflicted, I went astray. We have only to think of the Apostle Paul before he was the Apostle, as Saul of Tarsus on his way to Damascus. You know, dear friend, God was the first to apprehend Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus didn't apprehend the Lord. He didn't start to wrestle with the Lord. Oh, indeed not. But it was the Lord who took hold of Saul of Tarsus first. Don't you remember how he said, Saul, Saul, how long will you kick against the pricks? I've taken hold of you. You are really mine, though you're still kicking against the goad. You don't want to plow the field for which I purchased you. And finally Saul said, Lord, what will you have me to do? So you see the results of his wrestling. Saul of Tarsus did not come forth in his own strength and glory anymore. The vision itself impaired his natural sight for life. Never again did he see with his physical eyes as he had seen before. Now he was handicapped, and though he prayed thrice for the removal of this thorn in his flesh, it remained for him a mark of God's grace. So, too was it with Jacob. He now came forth halt. It was that which marked him and set him apart from all other people, wasn't it? Most people had two legs, and they walked, you know, evenly balanced, but not so Jacob. And so in this world, dear friends, the people of the world walk, as it were, on two legs, and they seem to be balanced. But you and I are maimed for Christ's sake. We cannot walk as they walk, for that which has come upon us hinders us from our walking as they walk. It is the consecration of our God that is upon us. I trust you understand what we mean by this, dear friend. It is this that cripples your walking insofar as your walking in the world is concerned. It is the touch of God upon you that has put this infirmity there. And this infirmity will not permit you to walk as others walk. That was the mark that Jacob received at Peniel. Yet how soon do we forget the grace of God that deals with us so? How soon we forget the trial we have gone through? How easily we fail to appreciate kindnesses that were extended and shown to us. But such things are easily forgotten. The wrongs we never forget. So we find Jacob, instead of going right on to Bethel, where God had once revealed himself, and where Jacob had made a vow, since you are with me, caring for me, feeding and providing for me, thou shalt indeed be my God, the God of my worship. But you know, instead of going on to Bethel, he stopped at Shechem. Not only did he stop there for rest and refreshment, But he purchased the land to stay there, and it was for 7 long years. And is it any wonder that living in the low-lying plains and associating with such people, he became lax in his relationship to his God and forgot, at least in a measure, his vow? You say, to what extent had Jacob forgotten? Well, I'll tell you to what extent he had forgotten. It became necessary for God to permit a deep trial, a humbling experience, to come upon Jacob through Dinah, his beloved and only daughter. And in what Simeon and Levi did, that humbled him even more to the dust. It was so contrary to his own spirit that when the time came for Jacob to die, and he would prophesy concerning and bless his son, he gave these no part in the inheritance. As far as Simeon was concerned, he was scattered throughout all the tribes. He got a little place in the territory that was allotted to Judah, and this merely of what Judah didn't really need. It is said that they became the schoolmasters, the teachers of their brethren, and so had not much of an inheritance. As far as Levi is concerned, he had, of course, no inheritance in the land at all. But he, at least, by the grace of God, was able to redeem himself, and God changed him, taking away the instruments of torture and death that were once in his habitation. He substituted for these the instruments of reconciliation and atonement. That is, he made of Levi a priestly tribe. So you see what God can do. And I say, dear friends, that in many of us there is a Simeon. In many of us there is a Levi, and I don't mean the Levi that was a priest, but the Levi that was cruel. Oh, would to God that we too were completely changed in our nature, no longer being conformed to the flesh and to this world, but transformed through the renewing of the mind, the heart, becoming more God-like and more Christ-like. And so we find, dear friends, that the humbling experiences brought Jacob to the point where he felt out of place among the people where he dwelt. God sometimes has to do that with you and with me too. He has to stir up the nest, make it uncomfortable for us, and we learn to fly. We're like those little eaglets in the nest who would never learn to fly unless the nest was made uncomfortable. That is how and why some of these hard experiences in time become for us hallowed resting places. Let us erect Ebenezer, so that as we look back in the days to come, we may remember the grace of God of other days, remembering also that he changeth not. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. With him, there is no shadow caused by turning. He who turns his back on the light will walk in the shadow, but he who keeps his face in the light may walk in the light even as he is in the light. He who has this glorious hope within him purifies himself even as he is pure. So we find, dear friends, it was only at the end of those 7 years that God again revealed himself to Jacob. Is God revealing himself to you from day to day? If you haven't had the revelation of God and his kindness and his love towards you, then the probability is that you're still living in Shechem. You are living in the wrong place. You will need some adverse experiences to humble you. And, dear friends, you cannot dwell in Shechem for any length of time without finding that you're losing something. You will not only lose the fellowship with God, wherein he can reveal himself to you, but you will also find that you are losing character proportionately. We would remind you also of the fact that when Rachel left her father, she took some of his teraphim with her. And because of Jacob's love for Rachel, he allowed her to keep them. He didn't say to her, cast them out, throw them away, nor that they savored of superstition. They were Laban's gods. They were not Jacob's. He should have reminded her that his God was Jehovah. They had acquired among the Shechemites many little trinkets of gold, earrings, and fetishes. In different ways, you know, they seem to have emulated their neighbors, wearing as they did these treasures upon their ears and around their necks as good luck charms, etc. But Jacob said nothing. He hadn't said anything to Dinah about her going down to visit the daughters of the Shechemites. Nor did he send one of her brethren along with her to be an escort. Nor was she chaperoned. No, Jacob had left the door wide open. And dear friends, that is the way it always is in Shechem. If we continue to live in these low-lying plains, we shall find that since God doesn't reveal himself, we lose our vision of God and we suffer proportionately in our development of character. We become loose and indifferent. It no longer makes much difference about this and about that. There are no essentials. The doctrines of the ransom and the sin offering, oh, they're not too important. And you're not too different from the people that you meet with. Birds of a feather instinctively flock together. You won't find a robin flying around with a blue jay. Of course not. And so we find that we tie ourselves in our own little bundles by the way we react to the providences of God. At the end of this period of 7 years, though Jacob was not a young man anymore, God says to him, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Do you see the point, dear friends? God had not said that he was to go to Shechem and to dwell there. But that's where he undertook to dwell himself. Now God says, you go to the house of God. That is the place that you call the house of God, Bethel, because it was there that I blessed you and gave you the reassurance of the promise. I think of Paul as he says to the church at Galatia, how soon are you removed? To others he says, yes, you would have taken out your eyes for me. But now there is a change. Well, dear friends, this is the way that God must feel when you do not give him such love as you first had for him. If you do not change your thoughts, he says to the church of Ephesus, I will remove your candlestick. This is what I have against you. You have left your first love. Oh, yes. When first you came into the truth, you were ready to set the world on fire. But now you say, I'm growing mellow. I wonder, is it a mellowing experience or timidity that comes by virtue of the fact that we live at or too near Shechem? And by Shechem, I mean the flesh, the low-lying plain. Not that you are part of it, but you're living so close to it that unconsciously you partake of it. Bethel is exalted ground. That's where God would have his people dwell. The house of God isn't in the low-lying plains. It wasn't in Sodom. It wasn't in Gomorrah. It was at Mamre. Nor was the place of God at Shechem. It was at Bethel. And so he says, dwell there and make there an altar unto God, who there appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. You see, God had to remind Jacob of the fact of that grace that had once been extended toward him. How often God has to do that with us too. We forget, or we fail to remember. But the result is the same. We live as if God never had done anything for us. Or, on the other hand, we think so much of the gift that we forget the giver. Thus, we fail to appreciate God, and we take all in our own stride, as it were. That was the reason that God had to tell Israel to stand still to see the salvation of God. He'll bring you to Pihahiroth too, to Pihahiroth by the sea. And when you get there, you will feel that you ought to be moving on. But he says, stand still and see that salvation isn't of you. It is of me. Whatever you have, whatever you are, and whatever you expect to be is wholly, completely, fully his grace. By grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It's the gift of God. So Jehovah says to Jacob, you go to Bethel and dwell there. Now that is very, very significant. That is also where God would have you to dwell. You say, I've got to go down to the valley. Spiritually speaking, you need never to go down into the valley. You might always live on the mountaintops if you would. And surely, God knows best. what is needful for us and arranges accordingly. He would have you come to an appreciation of what his will concerning you really is. And as we have already suggested, the shepherd often has to cripple the little lamb in order to make it obedient to his will. But when he does that, it is in love that he does it. In love, he picks it up and huddles it close to himself, close, as it were, to his heart. He speaks to it in loving tones. So don't be discouraged if God, for one reason or another, should inflict an infirmity. I don't mean necessarily a physical infirmity. It might be something else. But if he has inflicted it, it may ever be the messenger of Satan to buffet you. But it is still God's grace. Paul came to see that there was more glory that would redound to God when serving him with his infirmities than there might have been without these. But Jacob, despite the mark he bore in his flesh, would dwell in Shechem. Are we any different? No. Often we do the very same thing. We bear the mark in our flesh and yet seek fellowship with those that are not of the commonwealth of Israel. Then Jehovah told Jacob to erect an altar. What was that for? Don't you know? That's where you are to worship and pray. An altar is only a little bit of earth lifted heavenward. That's all it is. And when God instructed those of old on how to build altars, he said, I don't want you to bring any tool against it. I want you to use only virgin soil or unhewn stone to build it. Just as it were, that these come from the hand of God. Just raise it up a little bit to bring it close to heavenward. Someday this whole earth will be an altar, a little earth lifted heavenward, and all mankind will glory God as they offer themselves as acceptable sacrifices to God. Won't that be glorious? Bethel. The whole earth will be Bethel. It will be exalted ground. Yea, it will be lifted up. Can you picture it? The glory of the earth, with no more doctors, no more dentists, no more medicine, no more drugs, no more undertakers, no more grave diggers. No more of these memorial monuments for the dead. All these things will have passed away. What an altar this earth will then be. Close your eyes for a moment to the scenes of misery and woe, degradation and sorrow that yet prevail on account of sin, and picture before your mental vision the glory of the perfect birth. Not a stain of sin mars the harmony and peace of a perfect society. Not a bit of thought, not an unkind look or word. Love welling up from every heart meets a kindred response in every other heart, and benevolence marks every act. There sickness will be no more, not an ache, nor a pain, nor any evidence of decay, not even the fear of such things. Think of all the pictures of comparative health and beauty of human form and features that you have ever seen, and know that perfect humanity will be a still surpassing loveliness, the inward purity and mental and moral perfection will stamp and glorify every radiant countenance. Such will earth's society be, and weeping bereaved ones will have their tears all wiped away when thus they realize the resurrection work complete. What an altar, what a Bethel, this world will be. Next, Jacob said unto his household, and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. You see, dear friends, what happens when God reawakens one after he has allowed him to go down into the valley for a spell to learn, as it were, that the people of the land have really no use for him at all. Nor is it always for what we've done. More often, it's for what we are. Do you understand? And so here Jacob is all ready to leave. But where is he to go? God said, you come with me, yea, come to Bethel, and erect there an altar unto me. But Jacob, he knew that if he went to Bethel, the house of God, there would have to be some changes made, especially with regard to his family, etc. First, he had to see that the strange gods were cast out, and that those garments which had become spotted with innocent blood were cleansed or cast off, and fresh, new, sweet-smelling garments had taken their place. Is there anything sweeter than that? Did you ever go into a butcher store and see that old apron the butcher wears, all full of blood stains and dirt and grease? Well, God appreciates the difference, too. How often are we bespotted and soiled with the blood, as it were, of innocent victims? Often, too, we are guilty of the sins of a Simeon or of a Levi. Of course, we've never really killed anybody. No. But have we ever said or done something that would destroy another's good name, his reputation, or his character? You see, dear friends, if we do say or do these things, let us remember that God also sees and hears. Sometimes, perhaps, there is in our hearts the desire to see someone else set down a little lower than ourselves. We are not too happy to see them exalted a little higher. This, dear friends, is the spirit of the flesh. It is envy. It is jealousy. We begin in devious ways to stick our feet forward in an endeavor to trip them, to see them fall helplessly. But that isn't enough, for then we have to jump on them, as it were, with both feet. Oh, you don't do that? No, you shouldn't do it. Nor can you bring these things with you into the very presence of God, the house of God, Bethel. You may wear an apron to keep yourself clean, but you're not clean because you wear an apron. The apron becomes spotted, and he who gets his garment spotted, in the biblical sense, himself is unclean. He's not fit for the fellowship with his master or with his God. So Jacob said unto his people, be clean and change your garments. Now how about your friends? Have you any right to tell them what they ought to do or ought not to do? Of course, it all depends. There was one who once asked, am I my brother's keeper? He might have felt himself justified today when people say, just mind your own business. God asked Cain, where is Abel, thy brother? To which he responded, am I my brother's keeper? There was another who asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? And you remember Jesus' reply. Often, dear friends, we condemn ourselves in the same way as did this man. You find somebody has taken a wrong course. You say, well, that's none of my business. And you just keep right on going. Someone may see something in you, too, that isn't in order, that isn't quite right. And by minding their own business, they let you walk in the darkness until you bump your head. Why didn't they tell you there were no lights there? Why didn't they tell you there was a chair in that dark room? Well, who told you to go into the dark room anyway? But you did. And it would have been a help to you had someone told you to be very careful. They didn't. Do you? No. We just mind our own business, too. But, dear friends, it is our business, yea, even our duty, to help one another along this pilgrim way. If you see something in me that isn't right, please tell me. And if I see something in you, I must not tell everybody else about it. I must tell you, and you only. Brother Russell says, if they can give a reason for it, we've got to leave the matter there. We cannot go further. It may be all right between them and the Lord. We cannot tell. That, of course, doesn't excuse us from discerning what appears to be evil in our sight. And to the best of our ability, we must ourselves abstain from even the appearance of evil. We are not to condemn ourselves in what we would allow in others. Is it not our duty to correct a child? If you fail to do so, and that child stumbles or falls because of your failure, the responsibility is yours. You have a responsibility toward others. Do not fail to exercise it. God would hold you accountable. Jacob, recognizing his responsibility toward his God, therefore said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away your strange gods that are among you, and be ye clean, and change your garments. Note particularly, dear friends, be ye clean and change your garments. It wasn't just put on other garments. It is not that which makes anyone clean. Perhaps you know how it is, after working all day long in the heat of the sun, and in confinement, perhaps. You are all perspired, and of course, it affects your clothes. They're not a very sweet-smelling thing, are they, when they become saturated with the perspiration of the body? So, what do? You go home. Do you then just put on other clean clothes? I think not. Nor am I suggesting what you ought to do. Although, it might be well if you first took the bath. Certainly, it is well to be clean before you put on other garments. The outer garments should merely be an indication of the cleanliness that is underneath. It is important for us to get this picture. Jesus would have us note the beauty of the lilies of the field, and that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now, what is the glory with which the lilies of the field are arrayed? Is it something they merely put on the outside? No, it's the inner life shining through. If you that bear the vessels of God are inwardly clean, that cleanness will shine right through. It won't merely be so of the outer garment. Don't think for a moment that the robe of Christ's righteousness is intended to cover uncleanness. It is intended to cover nakedness, but not uncleanness. Do you understand the difference, dear friends? There is a difference. Of course, you can't help yourself from the nakedness of Adamic birth and inbred sin, but you can keep yourself from becoming unclean. We read then that as a result of this injunction of Jacob to his people, it says, "And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods that were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak, which was by Shechem." And then the account tells us that they journeyed on, and evidently the blessing and favor of God was showered upon them. For it says the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. Now these showers of blessing, of course, come to all who bring themselves into harmony with God and would cast out of their own lives, to the best of their ability, all that is inimical to the purposes of God. But we say, dear friends, there are showers and showers. Sometimes that we don't have a real shower of blessing that soaks through and through is because of the fact that we have done what we ought to do in obedience to the will of God, not as wholeheartedly as we might have done. We can rest assured that these showers of blessing may not always be to our liking. They may even hurt us. A little light shower, you know, just wets the surface of the ground. It sprinkles it a little bit here and there and cools it. Then the sun comes out again, and the rain is all evaporated with hardly any real refreshment. What you need is the showers of blessing that come down so hard that they bounce right off the ground, then drop right back again and sink down deep into the soil and reaching the little roots and refreshing them. And so we do remember a tale that we've often told, that we heard first from our dear brother Hirsch many, many years ago. He spoke about a great bed of nasturtiums I don't know whether you know what nasturtiums are. They're pretty little flowers that have leaves like miniature umbrellas. The pretty flowers are very fragrant in themselves. But I think it was in August, evidently. The upper atmosphere was quite cool, so that as the rain fell, it froze, and it fell in hailstones. And it came down real hard, so hard, in fact, that it tore those little flowers to shreds. When the storm was over, there was a field of nasturtiums, all in little shreds, but the air was redolent with the fragrance of these lacerated flowers. Sometimes God has to give us some real hard showers of blessing. They're not an indication that he doesn't love us or that he hates or despises us, but they are the very things which he knows will bring the greatest blessing to us and the biggest blessing from our lives unto others. So these storms, these showers, which come from the presence of God upon us, they may lacerate us like those little flowers to promote, as it were, a fragrance that shall emanate from us into the lives of others. So were God's dealings with Jacob. And the things which happened to Jacob were typical, of course. They were typical of what may happen to you and to me if God is dealing with us. I, for one, am glad that in his providences, God has afforded me the opportunity of studying these old-time pictures. For we have found in them, at least for ourselves, things that we had never known were there, and which we know God hid there for you and for me. I like to think oftentimes of a little girl whose father, coming home at night, would hide something that he brought for her. He'd hide it in the room and say to his child, "Now see if you can find what I brought home for you."
He didn't tell the child exactly where it was to be found, but that it was in that room. Sometimes he might say, "Well, now you're getting warm," as the child approached the place where the little treasure was hidden. "Or you're getting cold," as the child got further and further away from it. Suddenly the child would come right upon the spot, and the father says, "Now you're getting hot." And suddenly, there was a gleeful cry. The child had suddenly found it and rejoiced, not only in having found it, but rejoiced in its father's love. God deals with us very much like this. You go to the Word of God and search for the precious nuggets that he has hidden there. You know when you're getting hot, and you also know when you're getting cold. Suddenly you find the hidden treasure, and it's right in your hand. And how sweet it is to think that God hid it there just that you might have the privilege of finding it. Isn't it a lot more fun, if I may use that term figuratively, to hunt for it and find it than to have it laid right in our hands? Why, of course it is. It gives you a little room for exercise, and you have found it, and you may know that it is your own, and by your efforts, which count in this instance too. God doesn't need to be blessed. He doesn't need to be honored by you. He is sufficient unto himself. But it is you who need to be blessed. And this blessing comes to you in your honoring of God. When you pray to God and you thank Him for the treasures that He hid away for you of old and which He has enabled you to find, so that not only you might rejoice in the gift, but in the giver Himself, you are being blessed of Him. When you pray to God, you should bear this in mind, that He loves you, and that no trial, no matter how severe, is intended to be for your harm, but it is intended to be a shower, which for a while may inconvenience you and try you, but which is intended eventually to bless you. So would you pray to Him with the idea of changing His mind? Surely you wouldn't want Him to do that, would you? Because in the ultimate, you will find that His will is best, and that even behind the frowning providence, there is hid His smiling face. Jesus did say, "Father, if it be possible, if thou be willing, let this cup pass. Nevertheless, not mine, but thy will be done." That's the way it should be with us too. So let us arise and go to Bethel, and let us build there an altar unto God. And we'll find, even while we're on the way, that the blessing and favor of God is with us. We'll be showered with His grace and His favor and His love, and that no one will be able to do aught to us, save He permits it. And if He will permit it, then we can rest assured that it will work out for our highest good. The Apostle Paul realized this when he spoke of the thorn in his flesh, a messenger that was sent, as it were, of Satan to buffet him. Yet it was also the grace of God, which was sufficient for him. But let us not forget the purpose for which Jacob had left Shechem and had journeyed to Bethel. It was for the purpose of building an altar unto God and there worshiping Him. It was not an altar that was already prepared for him, nor an altar that others should build for him. The altar was to be his own, the result of his own labors and toil, so that he might worship there. It isn't always that way with those who profess to be the instruments of God. We have the instance of Balaam, who dealt with Balak of old, when Balak would have the children of Israel accursed so that he might have the victory over them. And Balaam, in this instance, you remember, he's called a prophet of God, a prophet of the Most High God. Yes, that's what he was. Brother Russell called him a God-fearing bad man. Balaam said to Balak, "Now you build this altar, and you do this, and you do that." However, when Balaam came into the presence of God, he says, "I built the altar. I offer the sacrifices." But you see, this was not so. And so, dear friends, if we see ourselves in the position in which Jacob was, then it will also be necessary for you and for me to see to it that we build our altars and that we worship there. Let it be noted that these experiences of Jacob were recorded for us
And that Jacob, when he had been at Bethel before, had promised, he had made a vow and said, since Jehovah is doing all of these things for me, he indeed shall be my God, the God of my worship. Well, how about you and me? Have we not also been at Shechem? And have we not also been lax and indifferent of the vows that we had made? Instead of coming directly to Bethel, where God could have encouraged us, what did we do? We stopped at Shechem. Now I say, pay your vows unto the Lord. He admonishes, he calls upon you, and he calls upon me to worship him, to praise him, and to come to him in the time of trouble. Oh, yes, we do call upon him in time of trouble, but generally it is while we are at Shechem, where we have not erected an altar unto God, and where he has not revealed himself. Now we should be willing, after the adverse experiences which have come to us because of our stay at Shechem, to come unto Bethel and there erect the altar and there fulfill our vows. Let us not forget that all of this travel toward Bethel and the erection of the altar would be in vain if we did not dispose of all of the false gods and the idols which we have accumulated, the strange gods and the idols, covetousness, etc., the worship of self is what it really is. All of these should be buried as we would bury anything that is dead. And if we have done this, we shall find that all of our worries and all of our fretting